comic books and the cartoons, TV shows, and movies that they've inspired are an enduring part of pop culture. And while young people are a primary target for them, a lot of adults anxiously look forward to the next movie or the next comic book to come out.
For a lot of people, it's only recently that they've started to see any number of superheroes who look like them on the page or on the screen. One recent example, a show that features an African-American superhero, Luke Cage, on Netflix.
Give us the money.
Yo, I don't like your tone.
Excuse me?
You're being disrespectful. It's unnecessary.
And our next guest has learned from his own experience that it's important for young people who don't normally have a lot of power to see themselves reflected.
Ryan Nguyen is with us now. He teaches English, theater, and communication at the College of Menominee Nation in Keshena, Wisconsin, where he's been recognized as the American Indian College Fund's Faculty Member of the Year. Ryan, welcome to Central Time.
Oh, well, thanks for having me. I'm really happy to be here, and what a great topic to be discussing.
Ryan, why do you think that comics and these superheroes in general are a good window for us to look through to view society and what's going on in culture in general?
Yeah, well, I think that the thing about comic books is for every generation, they reflect what's going on in the society. So you think of course, Captain America starting off punching Hitler in the 40s. And I really think the evolution of Batman shows it with Adam West talking about this Cold War kind of fighting the bad guys there to the Reagan era excess, the Tim Burton. And I wrote about this in the column I published. But if you look now at the current movies it's representing in the last Dark Knight series, the Occupy Wall Street movement, and even now with the Suicide Squad, which I'm sure we're going to get to, it talks about kind of an anti-hero, which we're almost seeing in this idea, of course, with an age of Snowden and people speaking out as whistleblowers, and sometimes with questionable morals and ideas. And I think that comic books has always been a great way to reflect that for society to talk about.
It seems like, as you're pointing out there, that the storylines have changed, the political tensions and the cultural focuses, that's definitely evolved and changed over the years. What about the people who are fighting, who might be the bad guys or the bad gals? Are the superheroes themselves changing to reflect a more diverse society?
Absolutely. I mean, it's certainly improving, and especially just fleshing them out so they're not a one-dimensional character. Of course, you guys just played a part of the Luke Cage series on Netflix, which is just wonderful in the Marvel Universe. And, of course, we're seeing Black Panther and some other wonderful storylines coming out. And that's certainly progress. There's some ways to go, of course, but it certainly seems to be that we're entering in to really a wonderful time for seeing diverse actors and diverse characters, really in all media, but specifically in this medium.
You mentioned the movie Suicide Squad, and these are kind of anti-heroes in a way, but there was a character there that caught your eye, Slipknot. Tell us about that movie and that particular character.
Well, in the movie, of course, talks about, as I mentioned, these anti-heroes, and hate to have a spoiler alert here, but if you haven't seen it, I apologize. But they are sprung from jail to defend the society with an absence of heroes, and they're implanted so if they stray too far, they don't make it. And Slipknot, played by Adam Beach, wonderful native actor, one of the best, he becomes the cautionary tale for the film. But that shouldn't negate the fact that it was a native character who was cast, who did a wonderful job, a phenomenal actor. And I think really what we're getting at here, and the idea is just minority groups seeing themselves reflected in the media and society. And then not only that, but being cast in roles that are typically, even though maybe written for minority characters, have non-minorities casted in those roles. And we're not seeing that as often now. It's not perfect, but we're moving in the right direction.
Well, what do you think it does mean to young people and students, and maybe beyond that too, adults who are out in the world and already through school? What does it mean to those people to see, say, a person of color who looks like them?
I think that it's very empowering to see someone that looks like you. Of course, for children to see someone and to look at the idols, the groundbreakers and whatnot, who they see, okay, this is someone who is from my ethnic background, who has my whatever demographic, social economic status from my state, and doing these things, and so maybe I can do it, and just to have that mirror of society. But then, of course, even for people from a different minority group to be able to look and to not focus on the stereotypes, but seeing and empowering roles. And I think that at a time when I think people are being reduced, and just as human nature, to just one or two facets, I think that seeing these more diverse characters is a great way to show the diversity, the color, the potential, the wonderfulness that can be found in all of us.
Ryan Wynn is with us right now from the College of Menominee Nation, and we're talking about why having diversity reflected in superheroes is important for students and society.
We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Growing up, was there a superhero that you felt reflected who you were, your experiences? If not, do you think it would have made an impact? If there was somebody like that, is there a character in a movie or TV show or book or comic book that has helped you or your child develop more self-confidence because they could really relate to them? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're picking up our discussion now with Ryan Wynn. He teaches English, theater, and communication at the College of Menominee Nation in Keshena, Wisconsin. Recently wrote an article about the importance of diversity in superheroes. And we'll take our first phone call now. We've got Glenn joining us in Waukesha. Glenn, hi.
Hi. I wanted to ask about superheroes which are maybe white in the comics and have been changed in the movies, for instance, Johnny Storm in the Fantastic Four movie. Do you think that's valuable, or do you think it's more valuable to have characters that are black or Hispanic originally, if you see what I mean?
Sure, Glenn, thanks for that question. And what do you think about that question, Ryan?
You know, I appreciate the question, of course. I think that's a really good conversation piece. And to be honest with you, I think they did a good job with casting someone from another minority group, not just from, you know, the Caucasian society. But I say this too, that I think what we're really thinking about here with it is, with a plot line, is it's reflecting society. I mean, we're talking about art, we're talking about fiction. And so what we're really looking at is just more an ability for people to look at the art and see a reflection of themselves. So I don't think it's so much as being true to an origin story as a true to the potential heroics that we see in society. And, of course, that comes from, in America, from our diversity. So I am all for having a diversity that reflects what makes us great and, of course, our art.
Glenn, thank you for that. And, Ryan, I've been thinking about the superhero pantheon. I have not seen or viewed all of it by any means. I've seen a chunk of, you know, the movies that have come out. And aside from Slipknot, there really haven't been, at least to my memory, other Native characters. Do you think that that's something Hollywood could do better at?
Absolutely. It's something that they could do better at. And, of course, that goes across all minorities. And so when we see the Oscars So White campaign from last year, and just this idea, of course, of underrepresentation. But again, I think that it's just limiting us as a society. And I do want to say specifically with Native Americans, there are wonderful Native comics. And so I think, of course, of Aragon Starr, who's a Kickapoo artist, who I think is just wonderful. And she is doing so much great work with Super Indian and Tales of the Code Talkers, and just wonderful stories that are for all ages and all audiences. So there is material out there. It's just taking these and giving them development deals and going beyond, you know, the people in the know, and hopefully our listeners out there are going to Google and looking up the Native Reality site that talks about some of these great artists and writers.
Let's take another caller now. We've got Brett joining us in Stoughton. Brett, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks.
I wanted to make a comment. One of the comic heroes that I actually enjoyed reading about is an ongoing online series called Spinneret. And what I like about that is it happens to take place in my hometown of Columbus, Ohio. Hmm. And it's not like there's no tragic backstory. It's a very regular protagonist. And to me, it's interesting that it's from where I'm from, so to speak.
And so that makes it more hits
realistic,
home to you.
Sort of.
Yeah, realistic. Yeah. Thank you for that, Brett. And someone talking about Brett there, the series taking place in his hometown, and I think that makes it more resonant for him. I mean, is there a way for people to have that sort of more local feeling in their entertainment when everything is produced in, you know, big content factories, usually on the West Coast?
You know, I think this is where arts in a small community or even a large community is just so important. I think that when in our society, of course, with social media, which is wonderful, and it's a great outlet and a great support system, but I think people coming together and supporting each other, whether it's in theaters or writers' groups or at libraries or in conversations like the one that we're having, and just saying, we value this art, we value this perspective, we value things that represent the diversity of what makes our country and our state so wonderful. And I think that seeing that and hearing that for people who perhaps aren't as engaged in sports or are looking for beyond that is just a piece that, again, we couldn't quantify the potential return on that investment.
Going back to some of the work, the art that's being produced, the storytelling from Native American writers and creators, are there places that you think the rest of us should know about, artists that we could start looking at and start bringing some of these voices to the forefront?
I like starting with the Native realities, as I mentioned with Aragon Starr. I just think her story of Super Indian is just really wonderful, and I just think that is really a great place to start, because it's good for all ages. But, you know, if you look beyond that, there are some other great series as well. And it's not entirely new. So if you go back to, in the 1990s, we had the Tribal Force. It was John Proudstar produced. And so, you know, this has been a slow burn. But I think that those Native realities is really bringing that together. And then from there, you'll find links to conferences. And then you can really go wherever your palate takes you to. But again, Aragon is really, for me, a great starting point for anyone.
What do students tell you about what it means when they see that diversity in the art that they're consuming, whether it's superheroes or whether it's something else?
You know, I think that it's a real positive thing that it comes out of every conversation. I do want to say that when I teach my students, 80%, vast majority minority students, is this idea that it's that they've gotten used to not seeing themselves reflected, so that when they have these opportunities to engage with the stories, that, of course, it resonates for them. And I just think that's great for them to see that, to have that potential, and, of course, the investment to the future. One other thing that I want to bring up for that other 20%, I often say to my students, you know, there's 7 demographics that divide us, and just how boring I think the world is if we only talk to people who have the same values, the same ideas, the same concepts, and are the same as us. And I just think, again, the diversity in America, and again, across our state, is just wonderful. And let's celebrate that. And let's look for stories that engage all of us and bring that strength to the forefront so we all can partake in it.
It's a great place to leave it. Ryan, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, it's truly my pleasure. Thank you, guys.
That was Ryan Wynn. He teaches English, theater, and communication at the College of Menominee Nation in Keshena, Wisconsin, where he has been recognized as the American Indian College Fund's Faculty Member of the Year. The opioid epidemic in Wisconsin has impacted people and communities around the state. Now it's getting the attention of transportation officials. In the last decade, the number of people who have been behind the wheel while on prescription drugs has gone up exponentially.
Wisconsin Department of Transportation Secretary Mark Gottlieb said he was amazed by 2015 drugged driving statistics. He said he hoped that public education campaigns could help lower those numbers. Yesterday, state officials released a new public service announcement about driving while impaired by drugs. Here's a listen.
Here's a dose of reality. Driving under the influence of prescription painkillers is just as illegal and just as deadly as driving drunk. In fact, drugged driving deaths in Wisconsin have increased nearly 200% over the past 10 years. Help prevent drugged driving and let's achieve zero preventable deaths on Wisconsin roadways. Driving on pills kills. A shared message from the Wisconsin Department of Justice and the Wisconsin Department of Transportation.
David Pabst joins us now to tell us more. He's director of the Bureau of Transportation Safety here in Wisconsin. David, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for inviting me.
We got a taste of the numbers there in that public service announcement. Can you talk about the rise of this problem that we're seeing with drugged driving?
Well, you know, last year, 149 people were killed in drug-related traffic crashes in Wisconsin. And that's, you know, over a decade, that's a 200% increase. It's just phenomenal. And over the last year, from 2014 to 2015, there's also a commensurate increase of about 54%. So it's a huge problem. Drug driving is a huge problem.
And I don't know if we can sort this out. Do we know how much of this is from people taking, you know, pain medications that they've been legitimately prescribed versus people taking someone else's prescriptions or illegal opioids like heroin?
Right. We don't have real solid data yet on kind of those proportions. We did do a study last fall with Dane County to try to determine that and determine if there is a roadside test that we can use from oral fluids to help us determine roadside if you're under the influence of drugs as well as alcohol. And the test is encouraging in that I think we'll be able to do it roadside. But the alarming part is, you know, roughly half the people tested for drinking and driving actually had one or more drugs on their blood system as well. So it's really something else. What we call it polydrug use, where you use more than one drug. If you consider alcohol a drug, opioids, marijuana, whatnot. A lot of people are taking a lot of things while they're driving, and they're putting everybody in danger.
Yeah, let's stick with the enforcement side here. Can you talk about what police departments around the state might be trying to do to spot these drivers and pull them over and detect if they're using one or more kinds of drugs?
Right. Well, we have to remember, of course, drug driving happens 24/7, so it's important for all our officers to be well-trained. The basic training that an officer gets allows them to easily detect alcohol-type offenses, and there's some advanced training that Wisconsin is one of the leaders in the country in offering, and it's called ARIDE, Advanced Roadside Impaired Driving Enforcement. And Wisconsin has over 2,500 officers trained in that particular discipline. So they know the questions to ask, they know the signs to look for the impairment, and they know how to follow up and get a blood test and confirm their suspicions.
I want to step away from the non-alcoholic drugs for a moment. Evidently, there's some good news on the alcohol side of things. Alcohol-related deaths down by about 38%. Those injuries down about 50% in the same period we're talking about with the drugged driving. What do we think accounts for that decline in alcohol-related deaths? That could hopefully point a path on drug driving, too.
Right. Well, you know, the very strong campaigns that we have, both law enforcement mobilizations and the media campaigns we use, is making a dent in people's attitudes towards drinking and driving. I think it's a social stigma right now for drinking and driving. But a lot of people are taking opioids, you know, even legal drugs, and driving, and they're impaired and they don't realize it. So I think we're seeing a downturn in alcohol-impaired driving, but an uptick in prescription-type drug driving.
We're talking about drugged driving with David Pabst, director of the Bureau of Transportation Safety here in Wisconsin. We've seen a big increase in statistics of people drugged driving, killed in drug-related traffic incidents. David, you mentioned that this could be not someone using illegal drugs. This is somebody taking their legitimate prescription and then driving. Do you think that there is this big lack of awareness that people don't realize the impact that an opioid pain medication can have on their driving?
I believe there is a lack of awareness, if you will, and that's why we created this advertising spot, this public service announcement, to try to get people's attention that they should be thinking about what they're taking medicinally. And then if you add alcohol to it, which some people might not even blink an eye and do, you know, they're just creating a recipe for disaster in their own lives and maybe the lives of somebody else.
And how about on the illegal use side of opioids and driving? Do you think that public outreach is going to reach people who are already doing something that they know is illegal?
Well, we hope so. And certainly we're trying to, you know, approach this in a holistic manner here in Wisconsin. We have the Department of Health Services, you know, the State Lab of Hygiene does testing of the blood and whatnot, and the Department of Justice and DOT. We're trying to, you know, treat this as more of a social problem than purely a traffic or purely law enforcement issue. We really have to get people's attention to realize, you know, and talk to their physicians, what's okay for me to consume or do when I'm on this drug. You know, some people get used to the effects of their drug and maybe that side effect is gone, but maybe it's not. Maybe their judgment is impaired and they can't tell if the drug is really a problem with them in their driving.
Yeah, you mentioned a cooperation between different departments at the state and doctors. This obviously, this isn't just a drug problem related to driving. This opioid epidemic, people are calling it, is it causes a lot of other problems too. Are you seeing more and more cooperation on dealing with this issue, whether we're talking about driving or other problems related to opioids?
Yes, I am. And Wisconsin has a strategic highway safety plan where we, try to incorporate all disciplines to try to move safety forward. And in the OWI and impaired driving realm, we have a very strong relationship with all disciplines, including the hospitals, including the Department of Health, DOJ, DOT, and all our other partners. And it's just, I do see strong cooperation here in Wisconsin.
In that public service announcement we played earlier, there was that phrase, let's achieve zero preventable deaths on Wisconsin roadways. Talk about that as a goal, and I assume that goes beyond just drug driving itself.
Right, that's our overall safety posture for transportation in Wisconsin. We believe that any death on the highways that's preventable needs to be prevented. So our goal is zero deaths, because how many deaths are acceptable for us on the highways? And the only goal there can be has to be zero, because if you're to say, well, it's okay to have 10, well, what 10 people are you going to allow to be killed out of your family or friends and acquaintances? So you got to kind of make it personal. Yeah, it's a stretch goal, but it's definitely a goal that is attainable. There are 8 areas in the transportation sector where we're pretty close to zero, and so we just got to keep picking away at it in as many places and areas as we can. It's an attainable goal. It's going to take some time, but what other goal is truly acceptable?
Outside of drugged driving and drunk driving and drinking and driving, which we've mentioned, what are some of the other areas of improvement to try to reach that zero preventable deaths on Wisconsin roads?
Well, we know that over 90% of all traffic crashes are not caused by the highways or by the vehicles people are in, but it comes down to the driver and their behaviors and making poor choices. So first thing you have to do, you have to wear your seatbelt. Wisconsin has an all-time high in its seatbelt use rate right now, about 89%. But now the state is behind the country and the neighboring states, which is up to 90-91%. So Wisconsin needs to, buckle up. We need to get 100% compliance wearing seatbelts. That's one of the areas. It's the cheapest, most effective way to save your life while driving a car is to wear your seatbelt. Speeding. We all need to slow down. We need to pay attention. I think one of the biggest dangers we have right now is distracted driving. We talk about the D's in transportation safety. You got drunk driving, got drug driving, got drowsy driving, and you have distracted driving. And distracted driving is huge, and that's on the big upswing too right now. So we all need to just put our phones down while we drive, turn them off, put them in the glove box, put the phones down, and concentrate on the task at hand. It's just so dangerous because you are cognitively distracted, you're manually distracted with your hands, and you're visually distracted by looking at the phone. So it's one of the most dangerous forms of distraction is that telephone.
You know, David, you're coming from an interesting perspective, I think, because I think for most of us who drive, it's a routine task. You know, it's something you do every day and don't think about it. You're looking at it from a perspective where it's a life or death issue that can be affected by pretty small changes, like avoiding, driving after taking that medication, as we're talking about. Are you hoping that more of us could start thinking about it the way you do?
Well, I would hope so. You know, it's certainly my job, but it's also my passion to get people to understand that when you're driving a motor vehicle, you have a 2,000 to 4,000-pound missile that you're directing it. You really need to realize the serious consequences there are when you're not doing it with your full attention and abilities.
As we wrap up, David, this PSA, this public service announcement on drugged driving is out. What's the timeline for some of the other pieces of the puzzle, the training of officers and things like that to come into place?
Well, we're always striving. We offer the A-Ride courses to all law enforcement. We do that annually. We also lead the country in drug recognition experts, is kind of a subset of the A-Ride trained officers. They're actually highly trained. There's about 230 of those. And we're in the top 10 in the USA with the number of DRE officers. But our goal is to have everyone get trained in A-Ride and as many more officers as we can handle the DRE, because it takes a lot of extra training and time.
We'll leave it there. David, thanks a lot for joining us today.
And thank you very much.
That was David Papps, director of Wisconsin's Bureau of Transportation Safety. He talked to us about a rise in driving while under the influence of drugs, especially opioid medications and heroin here in Wisconsin.